Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 116, I chat with Tyle Hertzens, the editor of innerfidelity.com, about the difference between objective measurements and subjective evaluations. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded June 18th, 2012. Episode 116, The Tao of Testing. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, online editor of hometheater.com. And this week's guest geek is Tyle Hertzens, the online editor. Let me try that again. Sorry. Mark, UK. Now, week after next is a different matter. No. 3, 2. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, online editor of hometheater.com. This week's guest geek is Tyle Hertzens, the editor of innerfidelity.com, an associated website to Home Theater, and a returning guest to Home Theater Geeks. Hey, Tyle, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Scott. It's good to see you again.
Yes, indeed. Those who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv or signed into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Tyle, and I'll pass along as many as I can. Now, Tyle, you wanted to come back on the show after you heard the podcast a few weeks ago with Steve Guttenberg, who is somewhat of, shall we say, he does not accept the importance of measurements and blind testing and objective standards by which we might measure audio equipment. And right after that show, I remember you wrote me and said, hey, I want to come on and give my perspective on that because it's a little different. So I'm really glad that we were able to put you back on here and we can talk about that very controversial subject.
Yeah, I'm very thankful, Scott. I appreciate your give me the time to come back on and beat Steve. Just help along a little bit in certain avenues.
Sure. Now, you know, this, certainly everyone's entitled to their opinion, and I welcome all opinions, reasoned opinions, I should say, anyway, here. For example, one of the points that he made was that graphs are maybe useful for technical people. Graphs, measurement graphs, I mean, measuring audio equipment, but not necessarily for consumers who are out to choose the product that they want to buy. And I'd love to hear your perspective on that. Can objective measurements be useful to consumers? Can they predict what a consumer might prefer?
You know, the only thing that measurements are going to tell you is how close something gets to neutral. And that's really going to be a lot of the gist of this conversation, is that there is a middle ground, a neutral ground. There is a place where you can say what is coming out is what is going in. And measurements help you know how close a headphone or a speaker or, you know, any piece of electronic gear really is to just being neutral, having the ability to take a signal in, do what it has to do with it, and then put out that same signal. So what you're hearing is what's on the track, so to speak. So I would say that measurements can give you an understanding of how close something is to that ideal of neutral. Now, the problem is that Steve is right in a way. Headphone measurements and speaker measurements and all sorts of measurements of electronic gear are relatively esoteric. And in that regard, they aren't terribly accessible to consumers. They would have to do some education for themselves. the truth is that Steve is right. These things are not easily accessible, but with a little bit of understanding on your part, you really can get a gist of whether a headphone is horrible or maybe good or maybe very good. But in the end, you actually have to listen to them to know that if, you know, that would be something you'd prefer.
Right. I mean, it seems to me that there, every audio device has a some sort of sonic signature to it, a certain sound, the way it sounds. And some people will prefer that one over another, which obviously measurements can't predict. But if people educate themselves a little bit as to what measurements might mean in terms of how that translates into how the sonic signature might be, and then learn what characterizes the sonic signature that they prefer, there might be that might be more useful information to them.
That's exactly right. One of the things you have to the problem is to really understand measurements, you have to have experience with the headphones, begin to have a sense of the way different headphones sound, and then look at the measurements and then sort of relate those two things. So there is that relatively long process. You know, you don't do it overnight. You have to spend some time listening to headphones and looking at graphs and listening to headphones and looking at graphs and comparing headphones and comparing the graphs of the headphones. And so it's not something you do instantaneously, that's for sure. But you definitely can develop an understanding of the types of things that you like and headphones that you like and how that may be a little bit different than what would be technically neutral. In other words, you might find a headphone you like, what the characteristics are that you like, and then you, in the data, in the graphs, you could see some characteristics that relate to that you like when you're listening to the headphones, and you go, okay, well, you know, looking at headphones that you haven't heard, you can see some measurements and you go, you know, that interests me. So mm-hmm. It is a good shortcut to develop a list of headphones that you think might work well for you. But it's a lengthy shortcut in the sense that, you know, you have to give it some time and energy and effort. And that's, I think the big advantage is that headphone enthusiasts do take the time, and then it does provide a sort of a benchmark, a stake in the ground of where things are, because the measurements are measuring something that's really there. So the advantage for people in the hobby is that it's an objective benchmark. In other words, it's something that people can look at and they go, well, this headphone is more bass than the other headphone. People go, well, no, it doesn't. And, well, yes, it does. You can see it in the measurements. And there's some obvious things that you absolutely can see in the measurements.
So it
keeps the conversation on track, I think.
Now, F-Loop in the chat room is asking, why is it that, quote, neutral on tiles graphs is not flat? And I wanted to get to this question actually too, that is neutral the same as flat, which is to say whatever level comes in at a certain frequency is the same level that goes out. The neutral headphones, he says, pardon me, tend to have a mid-high frequency shelf starting around 1 kilohertz. Is he correct? Is he perceiving that accurately?
As I measure it, yes, that's absolutely true. This gets very, very complicated. Another reason why Steve is right is in that the average consumer doesn't come in and instantly understand this stuff. But I have a graphic that do you have that graphic that I can actually show you some things?
Exactly. It has to do with how can you tell what a set of headphones will sound like from their measurements is I think what we're sort of aiming at here. And John, if you can pull up graphic number one, we can take a look at that, which I believe is frequency response.
Right. So these are a set of six frequency response. The top one is an AKG K701, and the next one is the 650. And you can see both of them drop off in the low frequency. So they're not flat in the lows, and they don't have quite enough oomph in the low bass, and that's true. And then the Odyssey LCD3 just below that, you can see is flat in the bass. So that's a flat headphone in the bass. Now, if we look at the higher frequencies in that, so that we need to shift over and take a look, the AKG K701 is a little bit bright, and the Sennheiser HD650 is a little bit soft, a little bit veiled, people would say. And so if you look at those two graphs, the top two on the right-hand side, you can see that somewhere between those two is probably about where flat would be. And the next graph down, the Odyssey LCD3, is somewhere in that region. And you can also see on the LCD3 that its very highest octave, the last 10 kilohertz, is a little bit brighter, a little bit more elevated than the other two. And that's probably also more correct. So that LCD3 plot, if you were to just smooth it all out, is about right, where the very highest frequencies should be 10 to 12 dB down from the low frequencies, and there should be a line between, you know, just about where you see it there, shelving down. Now, it's complicated. We can go away from this for just a second. It's complicated, really, what's happening, because this ridge in your ear amplifies sound, and so it creates a peak at 2 kilohertz, between 2 and 5 kilohertz. So there's a lot of changes that occur to the sound as it's getting to your ears from the headphones or from space. And that's
This is a wholly different, pardon me for interrupting, but this is a this makes it more difficult to measure headphones, it seems to me, because you have to ideally take that into account, and you can't because everybody's ears are different. A speaker or a piece of electronics, you know, you can measure a speaker in free space at a distance of a meter or whatever, and the electronics, you're just measuring over electronics. There's no acoustic interaction at all. But with the headphones, your outer ear, your inner ear, and the headphones all form a system that you can't possibly predict one person to the next.
Absolutely true. That a headphone is what you would call an acoustic coupler. And once it's put together on your ear and you start making sound in it, it acts as a whole. And there will be differences between people in the way they perceive that whole, because of the shape and size of their ears and so on and so forth. So you're absolutely correct. When I measure on my measurement dummy, one of the things that that measurement dummy has is an IEC specified ear. So the IEC, the European Electronic Standards Setting Organization, went out and measured thousands and thousands and thousands of people's ears and then came up with the average ear. And it is a highly specified shape that is this ear. And it looks like an ear. It looks exactly like an ear, except it's a little bit smaller than mine, but because it averages men's ears and women's ears. But the point of it is that the head that I use is very stringently established to be the average of what people will have. So yes, the measurements I take will be different than what a person would hear by some measurement. Now, you don't have bat ears, you know, you don't have dog ears, you have human ears. So it's not going to be vastly different, although it will be somewhat different. At any rate, when I do a measurement, I do subtract out this HRTF, this head-related transfer function. So the dummy comes with a curve that says these are all the things that this head does to sound when it gets to the ears, and if you want to get rid of it, then you use this curve. Now, the problem is the curve really isn't designed for headphones.
Is that dummy head used sometimes to measure speakers then, or to measure acoustic sounds coming from farther away?
No, because it does affect the sound. And so if you're measuring speakers, you want to use a calibrated calibrated instrumentation microphone
that would show the
sound as flat. Yeah. The most common use for these dummy heads is in automotive sound evaluation in cars. and finding road noise and things like that. They get used a lot in designing automotive interiors to be free of sound. Mm-hmm. But
or to minimize it anyway.
So again, the headphone measurements, the flat is, it's very hard to tell what's flat. You know, it's not the same.
But so what you call neutral is then in fact not flat.
It's not flat as displayed on my graphs, but when you look at my graphs and look at them relative from one to another, so if you compare graphs, mm-hmm. the comparisons will be accurate differences between the way two headphones sound. So it may be hard to know exactly where neutral is, but if one headphone has a big bump up in the bass, well, that means it's got more bass.
So really what you're looking at is the delta between one graph and the next.
Right. And one of the things that takes a while is for people to get used to about where that neutral line is and then compare headphones against that neutral line. So if we can go back to that graph.
Yeah, I was going to pull that graph back up and ask you, is there a headphone here that is most or closely represented that most closely represents neutral?
That would be that Audizy LCD-3, that third one down.
Okay.
And then the next one is the Soul Republic Trax. And this is intended to be a bass-heavy headphone. And you can see that the bass is louder significantly than the treble relative to the graphs above, that this headphone does have an overall tilt. You'll also see that it's also got a big notch in the mid-range, and that is a problem with that headphone. It's got a big notch in the mid-range, and you lose a lot of mid-range vocals. The next one down is the Beats by Dr. Dre.
Which is where most of the vocals are, in the mid-range.
Right. Right. It's a bad headphone for vocals because they just sort of disappear. And the next one down is the Beats by Dre Solo, which is supposedly a bass heavy headphone. But you can see the bass really isn't, it falls off earlier than that Soul. So, and you can see that it's very uneven. So that headphone has a lot of dips and ups and downs. And generally you hear that as something that's not very even sounding. And then the very bottom one is a very old headphone, the Fostex T50RP. This is a planar magnetic headphone. You can see it's got a very, you know, N-shaped curve, but it's very smooth. And this headphone actually sounds fairly good for an old AM radio. You know, it actually has a fairly nice sound. A lot of hobbyists work on improving that particular headphone, but you also see it's got a little bitey point up at 10K. So there you go. There's a sort of a general look at the frequency responsive headphones.
Right. Parker R in the chat room has a question. Is it still possible to get a cheaper headphone that sounds decent?
Sure, there's a number of inexpensive headphones that sound pretty good. Monoprice for $21 or something has a little headphone called the 8323, I believe. It's pretty good. The best inexpensive headphone in my mind is the Creative Orvana Live. Creative Labs, and Orvana is A-U-R-V-A-N-A Live, exclamation point. And that's a $60 headphone, roughly going at street price. Very, very good sounding headphone at that price. So yeah, you can get good inexpensive headphones. But you have to sort through them. There's some horrible inexpensive headphones as well. And there's horrible expensive headphones as well. So
Exactly. Virgil in the chat room asks, is distortion taken into account when you test headphones?
Well, I do. I didn't prepare any plots or any graphs of distortion. But if you go to the website, innerfidelity.com, up on the top navigation bar, there's a thing called a click called resources, and then under resources there's a data sheet to download, and on that page you'll have hundreds of data sheets for various headphones, and I do measure distortion, and it does vary from headphone to headphone in different ways and can tell you different things. And if you just click on the datasheet downloads there, you'll be able to see the go down. And then just click on any of those graphs right there. It doesn't really matter which one. And what you'll see is the full datasheet. And so at the top left is a frequency response. Top right is isolation. The next one down is impedance. And next to that is square wave response at 30 hertz. And then if we go down farther, we have those are the distortion, total harmonic distortion plus noise plots. And then the next to it, to the right, are the square wave. And the very bottom measurement is the impulse response of the headphones. And then a couple of single point data measurements to the side there. So, and I have it for hundreds of, probably about 300 headphones measured now.
You have all that data for 300 headphones?
Yeah. And it's not an easy task. Each of those measurements, if I sit in the room and do it, it's probably about an hour. But usually what I do is I just always have headphones measuring, and every time I walk by the room, I'll have it go do the next step. So I pretty much am measuring headphones continuously.
A. Barron in the chat room is asking, have you tested the new Heilsound Pro headphones?
No, I have not.
I'll try and get you some of those because Bob Heil is a member of the Twit family. He has his own podcast here on called Ham Nation. He's a big ham operator, ham radio guy. Yeah, but he also does microphones, and he just recently released his first set of headphones. So I'll be very interested to hear how they stack up.
Well, I'd love to get a pair to measure, that's for sure. Get my ears on them, because measurements aren't everything, you know.
Yes, exactly. In fact, a monkey mind in the chat room asks the next really good question, which is, do objective measurements always match the subjective experience? If not, what are some examples of when it doesn't?
Well, I would, generally speaking, the objective measurements match the subjective experience to the extent that they can speak about it. So if it looks like it's a warm headphone on the measurements, what you normally hear is a warm headphone. If it looks like it's got a bright, aggressive spot in it, then it usually sounds that way a little bit. On the other hand, there's things like Jerry Harvey 13 headphones, which I can't actually measure because they're custom in-ear headphones, but they have this juiciness to them that I don't know where that shows up on the measurements. I'm trying to think of one that deviates substantially from the measured values. There have been a couple that sound better than they measure. The Fidelio L1 sounds probably better than its measurements look. And then you have them where they sound worse than the measurements look too. But, you know, always in they always sound, you know, similar to what the graph looks like. But
is giving you some idea.
Yeah, it gives you a bracket, you know, kind of a basic idea, but it doesn't. You know, the important thing is it's two domains. You know, I am not a measurement piece of equipment. You know, I am a living, breathing organism that has this weird thing called consciousness that is experiencing things. You know, my tester does not experience, when I turn it off, you know, death.
Right.
it doesn't go, ooh, that sounds good, you know, and we are dramatically different than what a piece of test equipment is. Right. And our brains are wired so that we acclimate to sounds. You know, our brains change their response to what we hear. And a piece of test equipment is designed not to change its response compared to what it hears. You know, here. So when it measures something. So, I mean, we're just very different types of things. And that's the point where, you know, Steve's point becomes true again, which is, you know, in the end, you have to have that listening experience to have any idea, you know, what a headphone sounds like.
Right. It relates to a related question that I had, which was, have you ever come across the situation where two headphones measure very close to the same but sound very different?
Well, that AKG K701 and the Sennheiser HD650 that are on that the first two graphs on that set of graphs that I showed you previously measure a lot closer than they sound. Where the 650 sounds sort of a warm, lushy sound, and the AKG701 set of harshness. But you see, it's not all in the frequency response. There's also things that can be seen in square wave response, for example,
which we can look at in graph number two, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, and there's two. I measure square wave response two different ways. One is with a long square wave. So if you put up that graph, we can talk about low frequencies essentially. So here's that. The top is the Odyssey LCD3. You can just leave the graph that size. It'll be easy enough to see. And that's you can see it's a nice square wave right there. That's what it ought to look like. And because that headphone, the top of that thing is fairly flat. It doesn't fall off very much. You can say that it has very tight bass. The next one down is the Beyerdynamic DT1350, and it has fairly good bass too, but you see it's a little lumpy looking. And what that is going to sound like is that the high frequency, which is indicated by the leading edge of the square wave, so to the left of each square wave, you know, that first upward step.
Yep.
The mids are coming on after that first step. So that's going to have kind of a punchy mid-rangey sound with the highs a little relaxed relative to the rest of it, but a good strong bass. And then you can see the Audio-Technica M50, and that's actually got very good balance. So there's a nice balance between the treble and the mid-range and the bass there, but it doesn't have the bass extension that the LCD3 does on top.
And is that because the top of the flat, quote-unquote flat parts of the square wave are, in fact, not flat but at an angle?
Well, right. That's what you see. And as the headphone tries to maintain that pressure for a long period of time, it has a hard time doing that, and that's the low frequency. So you can see by the time you get to 30 hertz, which is the length of this square wave, it's fallen completely off to zero on that M50. So it doesn't have bass extension to 30 hertz. It falls off before then. And then the last one is the AKG K701, which was in that other graph, and you can see that it has a fairly bright leading edge. You see the peak on the leading edge is quite pronounced. Yeah. And then the low frequency has that inward dipping of that curve, and that means that it has a thin bass response. So you can see that that's substantially different than the other headphones there. Now, that's the long square wave. And we also have some graphs of the short square wave where you're really zooming in on that leading edge. So if we can go to the next graph, we can show even now this is just a 300 hertz square wave, and so you're seeing
just even all that very high frequency.
Right. Now you're seeing just the leading edge and what it's doing. And the very top headphone is a Sennheiser HD800. Now this is just about perfect. What you want to see is a very fast leading edge, a little bit of overshoot, and then it comes down to be what's called critically damped, and it's not quite critically damped on the HD800, but so you've got a nice little spike, and then it comes, it flattens out, and it has very little noise there. Now, that means that it's a clean headphone with no ringing and resonance or very little ringing and resonance, and that it's very fast. And so the HD800 is the headphone that images very, very well. The next headphone is the Grado SR325, and you can see that its leading edge spike is very pronounced, and there's a lot of noise subsequently. So this is going to be a grainy headphone with a sharp-sounding response, going to be a bit harsh-sounding. The next one is the DT1350. That was the one with that humped shoulder we saw earlier on. Okay, and so this one, you can see that leading edge is not that little blip on the leading edge is not really any higher than the top of the square wave here. And it should have a little bit of a more overshoot there, which will give you a little bit more better high frequency response. So these headphones have a little bit withdrawn high frequency response. Now the next one, the LCD 3 is what's interesting about it. It has a little double dip there. And if you look at the Sennheiser HD800 on the top, it really has a single overshoot, and then it comes back and settles in very quickly. I think, and this is just guesswork so far, but this second hump, and when there's multiple humps, you have a number of leading edges, in essence, that tend to make it harder to have good imaging, because the arrival time of the signal isn't sensed as cleanly as when there's a single blip like there is on that HD800 on top. However, you can also see that that Odyssey LZD3 square wave is very, very noise free, other than that artifact. So this is a very clean sounding headphone. It actually has a very nice response. That first overshoot is about the right size. Okay, unlike the 800 on top, which is has a little bit too high of a peak, but it has two of them. And the the LCD3 is a lovely headphone tonally, probably better than the HD800, but it doesn't image quite as well. And then the last one you can see on the bottom, this is an Ultrasone Pro 290 or something like that. You can see it's got three of these very severe rings in the front, and it doesn't image very well at all. So,
Ultrasone is a pretty high-end headphone, isn't it?
I guess it depends on who's saying whether they are or not.
Well, I know they make one, at least, that I heard somewhere at a show, the 10, the Pro 10. I forgot the model number, but it was very expensive.
Yes, very, very, very expensive.
and this is not that one.
No, but its measurements aren't much better.
No, no kidding.
No, they're not very good.
Wow.
Yeah, they're very poor. In fact, Ultrasone has a theory, they call it S-Logic, that that the sound will go by your ear in a more natural way if the entry from the driver is down low and forward. So they put the driver down low and forward in their earphones, and the sound, according to them, travels past your ear in a more natural manner, which I simply don't buy, because sound normally comes in a plane wave at your ear. It doesn't travel up your chin towards your ear.
Right. Beatmaster asks, how many times do you repeat your measurements? Do they vary from one run to another?
Absolutely. Yeah, they do. In fact, I have an article where one of InterFidelity's readers is a quality engineer at electronics, a military electronics manufacturer. And I did a bunch of measurements of a pair of Sennheiser HD800 headphones. First, a series of five not moving it, and then a series of five where I did move it, and then a series of five full sets of measurements. And I'll go talk to that about that in a second. And then he analyzed the stability of the measurements, the repeatability of the measurements over time, and found that they were very repeatable up to about a kilohertz, and then became less repeatable as you went higher and higher in frequencies. One of the things that I do on the measurements is every time I measure a pair of headphones, I actually measure the frequency response of the headphones five different times. So I center the headphone, and then I move it slightly forward and measure it, and slightly back of center and measure it, slightly up, slightly down, and then right in the center. And what that does is the very high frequencies of the headphone measurements tend to vary very widely. In other words, there's a lot of peaks and valleys in the high frequencies of headphone measurements. And the reason for that is because of the peaks and nulls in the resonances of the ear canal and the concha chamber and the distance between the driver and the ear and so on and so forth. So there are a lot of resonances inside the ear, the coupler that is the system of the headphone and the ear together.
And where you place the headphone with respect to the ear would then affect where those resonances are, what frequencies they are, right?
Exactly. The distance, if you change the distances, then the frequency of those resonances change. And so by putting the headphones in five different places, and then what I do is to average those five measurements and then apply the head-related transfer function compensation. So that's called spatially averaging. So I spatially average the frequency response. If you look on the data sheets in the frequency response section, there's a bunch of gray measurements, and those are the five different measurements uncompensated. And then the blue and red frequency response would be the compensated averaged frequency response. And you can see that the noise is significantly less on the final measurement due to this spatial averaging.
Oh, okay. Let's see. A lot of people in the chat room are talking about the Grado 60s. SR60, I believe, is the model number.
Uh-huh.
That's what do you think of that one?
You know, first of all, it's well known amongst the hobby that I'm not a big fan of Grado. But I will say, without question, that the Grado SR60 is one of the most classic headphones. It's actually a fabulous headphone at its price. I think there are now better headphones at that price. I think the Sennheiser PX100 earpad headphone is probably better sounding than the Grado is, for example. But the Grado, it's a very good, still competitive headphone. It's been around now for, got to be going on 20 years at this point.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a great little headphone. So I would definitely not diss that headphone.
Well, when you say for its price, what is its price range?
It's about $89, $69, yeah. $79, $89, right in there, just under $100. I can't remember it exactly. But
Metro Scenes asks, do noise-canceling headphones have a negative effect on the sound compared to non-noise-canceling?
As a rule, noise-canceling headphones are all over the map in terms of what they do. For example, when I heard the Fanny Wang noise-canceling headphones, I got their 3000 series noise-canceling headphone. And one of the things that you have to do with noise-canceling headphones is listen to them while you're in a noisy environment. So I actually have my system set up, my desktop system set up, and I'll play music through my iPhone or from some other source into the headphones, but my desktop listening system will be playing pink noise or brown noise. So I'll use both of them, pink noise and brown noise, because brown noise is more like what you get on an airplane. Sometimes it affects the way the headphones sound a lot. Like with these Fanny Wang headphones, they sounded really just terrible with the noise canceling on. And then some headphones do a great job of not being affected by the sound. The Bose Quiet Comfort 15s, to my recollection, because it's been a while since I heard them now, are really, really good. I actually just today, just before this show started, got another pair of QC15s, so I'll be testing them shortly. And I do have the new Klipsch, the new PSBs, the new Polks, the new Audio-Technica ATH ANC9. So I'm doing a bunch of noise-canceling headphones. And so, yes, they do change when you are in noisy environments, some a lot more than others.
Mm-hmm. How do you test noise-canceling headphones? Measure is what I mean. How do you measure noise-canceling headphones? Do you turn on the noise-canceling circuits? And in your test chamber, I wouldn't imagine there would be any noise in there.
Well, I do have a speaker in there, and I can play pink noise on that speaker. And so I do an isolation measurement where I have recorded the pink noise on the head without headphones on. And then I do the measurement of the frequency response with headphones on, and then subtract the two from each other to get the amount of attenuation the headphones are providing. So I do turn the noise canceling on the noise canceling headphones when I measure them. And I do measure the amount of isolation they provide, but I don't measure their frequency response with noise on in the chamber. So the noise canceling is on, but I don't measure the headphones in the presence of noise. That becomes a very complicated measurement. And so my preference is to actually just listen to that, to listen to the way the headphones sound when I am in a noisy environment versus not in a noisy environment, which is very easy to do. I just play pink noise or brown noise on my speakers and then turn the speaker, you know, turn the mute on or off, and I can very easily hear the difference between how the headphones sound in the presence of noise and not. So
for definition's sake, define pink noise and brown noise. What's the difference? And white noise too, while you're at it.
And white noise, yeah. I may not get this exactly right, but what white noise has equal amplitude of every frequency. Pink noise has equal energy per octave of the frequencies, and then brown noise is a 6 dB tilt to the pink noise or something like that.
Brown noise has more low frequency energy than high frequency. Is that what you're saying?
Right, exactly. And white noise has more high frequency energy than lows because it's the same amplitude, but there's more frequencies per octave. So you end up having more energy per octave. And pink noise is one of my favorite test tracks. I almost always listen to a pair of headphones. I listen to pink noise first on them because you can hear, you know, if it's right, it's very, very smooth sounding, and you really can't pick out any particular peak in the frequencies or and then if there is some peaks or valleys, you know, it becomes quite readily apparent listening to pink noise. So I use pink noise a lot in both subjectively and objectively, really, because some of the measurements are done with pink noise.
Right, exactly. Well, I want to get to subjective in just a minute, but before we do, I do want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Netflix. Netflix, of course, as most of our listeners and watchers know, lets you stream thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to your TV, your Blu-ray player, gaming console. Just about any electronic device made these days has a Netflix app on it. Tablets, your PC and laptop, of course, cell phones, or rather smartphones. Got to get away from using that term. But in any event, just about any device that you can imagine has a Netflix app on it that will let you stream thousands of TV episodes and movies to your TV or whatever display device you have instantly, saving you time, money, and hassle. You can even start on one device and finish on another, which is the ultimate inconvenience. For your 30-day free trial, you can go to netflix.com/twit and check it out. Those of you who already have it know what I'm talking about. Those who don't, please do go to netflix.com/twit for your 30-day free trial. And we thank Netflix very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire Twit network. So so now I still do have a couple of questions in the chat room that I want to get to you before we run out of time. And one of them was, does the Sennheiser Orpheus deserve its legendary reputation? We should say that the Sennheiser Orpheus, probably one of the most expensive pair of headphones ever made. What were they, $17,000, $20,000, came with their own amplifier?
Yeah, 17, I think, was the list.
Yeah. Did you ever test them? Do they deserve their reputation?
I think they're good. They're not as good as the best of the Stax. The Stax SR007 and SR009 are both better headphones, in my opinion. I'm probably not going to remember that proper designation. I think it's HE90 is the designation for the earphones that came with the Orpheus. They're good, but up in the top, you know, five or so electrostatic headphones. But I don't think they reach what the 007 or 009 get to. The Stax SR009 are recent, maybe 6 months ago or 8 months ago now, and absolutely just incredible headphones. Very, just a beautiful sounding headphone. But I wouldn't use the Stax amplifiers with it. I would use, for example, the Headamp Blue Hawaii, which is a really a lovely headphone amplifier. So, but you know, now you're talking about $10,000 rig too. So
right, exactly.
Not cheap.
In fact, Dr. T in the chat room asks, is there a matching issue between different amps and headphones where the headphone, a certain pair of headphones might sound better on a particular amp, and therefore you need to be concerned about matching them together?
I would say that the headphone is the thing that varies the most. Okay. So the headphone is the most important thing to get right for you, because the headphones vary more than sources or amplifiers would vary. And then
you just said that you wouldn't use the Stax, for example, with the Stax amplifier. You'd choose a different amplifier.
Yes.
Why
yes.
is that?
Well, because it's the world's best headphone. And so then to make it really worth your while, you need to get the world's best amplifier that for the driving that type of headphone that go with it, you know.
All right.
So I'm not saying that the amps don't make a difference. I'm saying the biggest difference in the chain is the headphones themselves. And then after that, it's probably the source being the biggest difference. Having a good source is very, very, very important. Mm-hmm. And then the amp is less important, but it's still a key to the system. And the answer is sure. Some headphones will react and or sound headphone amps will sound different with the headphones. Some headphone amps have relatively high output impedances and therefore will interact with headphones that have low input impedances. So sure, there are another example is I mentioned the Jerry Harvey JH13s before. These are balanced, multiple balanced armature driver ear, you know, in-ear headphones, and that have a fairly large swings in impedance. These balanced armature drivers have fairly large impedance swings, and okay. when you use them with a portable device that has a fairly high output impedance, then there will be some interaction. So it's better to use an amplifier with these headphones than straight out of the iPhone, and you'll be able to hear the difference relatively easily. Although they sound great straight out of an iPhone, but amplifiers make a difference, but the headphones and the source are probably the more important than the amp.
Have you heard the Hi-Fi Man electrostatic headphones? I just got a visit from the creator of these headphones, and he was playing me a prototype of his new MP3 player through his headphone amp and his electrostatic headphones. Sounded pretty good to me. It was just a short demo, but still.
Electrostatic headphones or planar dynamic headphones?
Good question. They might very well be planar dynamic. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I think Fang Bian is his name.
That's his name. Yep.
Yeah. And Fang's has just come out with a new MP3 player. He makes a variety, a whole line of planar magnetic headphones, similar to the Odyssey headphones that were in the graphs that I showed you. I in particular like his HE5, I think it is, 500. HE500 is very nice. And he came out with an HE400, which is a low-cost planar magnetic headphone. It's probably the lowest-cost planar magnetic headphone you can get out. Well, the Fostex T50 ERP is less expensive, but it sounds pretty good. So he's doing some good work with planar magnetic headphones. Does a good job.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. I prefer the Odysseys. Because they're a little warmer, and my tendency is to like things a little laid back rather than a little bright. And Fang's stuff, the Hi-Fi Man planar magnetics tend to be a little bit on the bright side, and not excessively so necessarily, but a little bit. And then the Odyssey's tendency is to be a little bit laid back from neutral, and that's just generally my preference. So.
And there we get to subjectiveness.
Exactly.
Which is, of course, you can't measure it. What we hope we've imparted in this show is that if you look at the measurements, you can narrow your choices. Once you learn to read and understand what those measurements are telling us, you can then say, oh, well, I'll probably prefer this one if I like a warmer headphone or a brighter headphone or whatever. And then you can go and listen to the ones that you've selected, that you've narrowed the choices to. But I think you would agree, wouldn't you, that as important as measurements really are, and I'm really glad that you do them for everything, you really need to go and listen to them and decide what you like.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's no, you know, I think there's steps that you have to go through in buying a pair of headphones. Read the reviews. Read reviews from people who are critical, not just, you know, saying what's on the box. And then the measurements, if you can take a look at them and understand them. And then head-fi.org, it's the biggest forum for headphones, is a good place to search for information on a pair of headphones. And then they also have meets where you can, they organize, self-organize little local meets so that you can go have a listen to the headphones. And that's really the next step after the measurements and reading all about them is to go have a listen to them. And the meets are a great way to do that. Mm-hmm. And then you got to dive in and buy a pair and see if you like them.
Mm-hmm. F-Loop in the chat room asks a great question. When you do a review, do you finalize your subjective impressions before doing or looking at the measurements, or do the objective measurements influence your subjective impressions?
That is a good question. And I always spend some time listening to the headphones first. I make some notes about what I hear, and then I'll measure the headphones and I'll look at the measurements while I'm listening again. And what I'll find is that a lot of times I'll hear some artifact that I can hear and sort of understand and make a kind of guess at. And then I'll see the graph and go, oh, that's what's going on. Mm. So there does come a point where the two get mixed together. And so both the objective measurements and the subjective impression come together at some point, and that's sort of the final take comes out of that. But I do always listen to the headphones subjectively first to see what's up with that. A good example of that one is the Sony. I'm not going to remember the number exactly. ZX700, I think it is. It's just a small, regular old pair of sealed headphones, and I like the way they sounded. And then when I saw the measurements, they didn't look as good as I thought they would be. And then you sort of picked out, oh yeah, you know, the cymbals don't quite sound so natural. It had a double leading edge blip on them, you know, and so
on the square wave test. Yeah.
It helps me zero in on stuff, you know, that but the point there was that it was a pleasing headphone, and you wouldn't know that from the measurements. So you do have to do that part first. Am I pleased by these headphones or not? Is there something that's annoying about these or not? And I do that right out of the box without measure. Well, I always burn them in for a little while too, even though that probably doesn't make that much difference, but I still do.
Web4947 asks, which are better, the Sennheiser P8 PX100II or PX200II?
It's a PX 100 space 2, the Roman numeral 2i. Right. So it's a whole, they sometimes make it really hard with their designations.
And these model numbers, I got to tell you.
Yeah, I know, it's terrible. But the 100 is an open and the 200 is a sealed. Okay. And so if you want a little isolation, you go with the 200. If you want to open, the 100. And the 100 does sound better. It's a smoother sounding headphone, cleaner sounding headphone, although it doesn't quite have the bass that the 200 has because it isn't trapping the air in there, although the 200's a little more uneven sounding. So that was a nice little waffle saying they sound different. But I'd say the 100's a little better sounding.
Mm-hmm. That brings up the question let's see, Virgil in the chat room, who asks if different types of headphones, on-ear, in-ear, around-the-ear, if that form factor affects the results of the test. I guess you can't test in-ear monitors, can you?
Well, I do. The head that I use does have a calibrated ear canal. So its ear canal does meet, does have characteristics of the human ear canal. In other words, the even to the extent that the microphone at the end of the ear canal, the diaphragm compliance of the microphone is the same as that of the eardrum, believe it or not.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is very cool. It's nose Wislocky coupler. And that's probably some weird geek inside joke. But yeah, a Wislocky coupler is a really calibrated ear canal. It has little air chambers that you can tune off to the side and things like that. But it's not quite that good, but it's good. Steve Guttenberg and I almost got onto this conversation on the 404 the other day, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it. But the answer is yes. The size and shape and the way the headphone is, whether it's on ear or in ear or around the ear, does make a difference to how they sound. For example, if you take a full size around the ear headphone, the pinna, the outside part of your ear, is reflecting sound off of it at the high frequencies in a relatively normal sort of way. So the ear is providing some of the cues, these notch filters and delays that it would normally do that provide localization information. And in-ear headphones, the ones you put in your ear canal, don't have any reflections off your pinna. And there is a big difference between full size around your ear headphones and in ear headphones in the size of the image that you perceive. Because when you have in ear headphones in, there are none of these cues, and it's sort of more sterile and removed from what you would normally perceive as the real world. And the image appears to be substantially smaller than the image on full size headphones, where you have some of these cues. It tends to make the image a little bit bigger. So there's that difference as one example.
Mm-hmm. And that seems to think about how the different types of headphones affect perception. Do they affect the testing that you do, or the results of those of that testing? Measurements, I mean.
In a way, yes, certainly, because you'll have different types of reflections and things like that from in your headphones.
So it'll affect the resonance peaks, for example.
Sure. Yeah. When you do in-ear headphones, I don't measure the in-ear headphones five times, for example. I have a different test for those. So I just get them seated properly and then just do one measurement, because there's no reason to do five measurements. It doesn't change, you know. You just get the in-ear headphones seated in their proper place, and then you don't have to move them. And there aren't any of these. There are a couple of peaks that occur from the length of the ear canal, but it's this. You don't want to measure the headphones not in their optimal position to make that peak move, because then you'd have changes that it wouldn't be like the way you'd wear them.
So, right. Well, I want to end with subjective here. We've been talking a lot about objective measurements and subjective listening. It sounds like you're balancing the two, really, in your reviews. And I think you're probably advocating that shoppers for headphones might want to do something of the same thing. Or at least, again, as I said before, use the measurements to narrow your choices down and then go listening.
Yeah, absolutely. The subjective is the goal. I mean, the goal is to experience music. So that is absolutely true. I also have to say that I don't try to write too much about this subjective experience on the headphones. I mean, I do a little dancing about architecture, but not a lot of it, because one, people's ears are different. They're going to hear things different. They're going to prefer different things. There's no reason for me to. And so I try to get to the point of really just narrowing it down of, you know, these are terrible headphones and nobody should buy them. These are okay. And, you know, some people may like them. And then these are really good. And then I'll have a little bit about, they tend to be a little towards the brighter, tend to be a little warmer, tend to have a little loose bass or a little tight bass or sound, you know, lushy or dry or whatever it happens to be. I'll talk a little bit about that. But in the end, you know, if I talk too much about that, it's not necessarily relevant. So I try to go as far as I need to go to give people a good gist of what the headphones are like, and then the responsibility lies on them to go have a listen. And yes, so I do try to straddle the line between objective and subjective. I do have to stand on my tippy toes sometimes across that fence, in the end, I think it's a good balanced way to do it. Same like John Atkinson, you know, he believes that both the subjective and the objective evaluations are both part and parcel of the evaluation of a product. But, you know, in the end, it is the listening experience that we're talking about.
Yes, and trying to put that into words has always been the real challenge to audio reviewers. You know, for example, you used the word juicy earlier, and several people in the chat room were sort of saying, "What? What does that mean?"
Yeah, you know, if that's the way it sounds to me, then that's what I'll write down. You know, and people will either get it or they won't. You know, at some point, the words are no better than the measurements at telling you what the experience is like.
Very good point.
We can come close, but you know, it's still not the listening experience. So
right. same with wine or any evaluation of a sensory experience.
Absolutely.
You know, you can talk about it to a certain point, but it's not going to get you all the way there. You have to actually go experience it for yourself. And your experience may, in fact, be different. You might have a different hearing profile. You might have hearing loss at certain frequencies. You might have wax in your ears. Somebody in the chat room earlier said, I just got back from the audiologist. I had my ears cleaned out. Wow, things are sounding a lot different now, you know?
Yeah.
And I do that a couple times a year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's you know, that's why there's a hobby of headphone listening, because
right.
There is that need to go out and listen to stuff, and there's no substitute for that. And you know, one of the great things about headphones is they're small enough to bring over to somebody else's house and have a little get together and, you know, sample all the various things. But
yeah. Well, final question that was asked in the chat room a couple times. What are the headphones you're using right now?
Well, you and I are both wearing Bowers & Wilkins headphones. You're wearing the very, very nice P5, and I'm wearing the new P3. The P3 is similar to the P5 in build, but not quite the sexy chrome and metal leather. these are a little bit daintier and more feminine, I guess is one way to put it.
They're both on-ear. They're not over-the-ear.
These are both on-ear headphones. I would say neither of these headphones have great fidelity. Both of them are a little bass heavy, and both of them have reduced high frequency response somewhat. But I find with telephone calls and things like this, where there tends to be some harshness in the sound, oftentimes YouTube viewing and so on and so forth, the convenience of these headphones outweigh the need for fidelity in those types of applications. And that's another story for another time, but you know, these headphones are something you wear, so the comfort and convenience and styling are all important too.
Not exactly.
I put the sound as the most important thing, but the wearability and usability and comfort are all very hot. You know, they need to be talked about a lot more than in audiophile gear or something like that.
Right, exactly. In fact, I did get a question about that earlier that I didn't pass on. What do you consider the most comfortable headphones? But let's save that for another time. I definitely want to have you back
sure.
on the show. You are just a font of great information, and I sure do appreciate you being here.
Well, I appreciate being here, Scott. It's always fun to join you on your show.
Great. Thanks so much. Tyle Hertzens is the editor of innerfidelity.com. So if you have any interest in headphones whatsoever, that is the place to go. My online home is hometheater.com, and you can email me at scott@twit.tv and follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Jeff Tully from THX, who's going to tell us about a new technology from THX called Media Director, which encodes certain metadata about how content is produced in order that it can be reproduced in the home more accurately, more according to the director or the content creator's intent. So I'm really looking forward to that, and I hope you will join me. Until then, geek out.